Hello and welcome to episode 83 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. And it's a special episode today. We have a special guest who we'll introduce very shortly. But just to go around the table, we'll introduce people. Perry, my co-host Perry Middlemiss is here as always. How are you, Perry?
Oh, good, thanks, David. And oddly enough, we're doing this particular recording face-to-face.
Indeed.
Very rare in the annals of the old Two Chairs Talking.
We're doing it in Perry's house too. And our special guest here is W.H. Chong.
Yes, hello David, hello Perry.
Chong's been on our podcast before, Perry's interviewed him before, so we'll have a chat later on about a couple of books. So are there any news?
There's not a lot of news around, especially in the awards arena, because finally we've got to that part of the year when there aren't many more awards left to hand out.
Thank goodness.
Thank God for that. I mean, you can get to the point where you can get overloaded with awards and awards news within the SF and mystery fields, but I think we're pretty much done. There might be one or two left to come through. There's probably a few Australian Literary Awards that we're interested in, Premier's Awards and stuff like that. Prime Minister's Literary Award, has that still got to come?
I think that's still got to come.
Yeah, I think that's still got to come. But anyway, so that'll be around some stage.
What we'll get next is the Best of the Year, which generally comes out in like in December.
Yeah.
In the newspapers, the New York Times Best of the Year.
Because they're trying to sell the books for Christmas, aren't they? So that'll be out and about pretty soon. But the main piece of news I have is a bit unfortunate news about the death of the SF author Greg Bear, who passed away yesterday. He'd suffered a series of strokes and passed away in hospital yesterday. Now, he's been around for quite some time. He was 71, born in 1951. His work covered a lot of major SF themes over the years, and such as galactic conflict, parallel universes, and accelerated evolution. He won the Hugo Award for his novelette Blood Music in 1984 and for his short story Tangents in 1987. And he won 5 Nebula Awards in total, 2 for Best Novel, and they were Moving Mars in 1995, and Darwin's Radio in 2001.
I remember Darwin's Radio, that was good.
So it's going to be a while before we get to those on the Hugo time machine.
I should think so, yes.
Sometime. And I also found out that he was one of the co-founders of the San Diego Comic-Con, which is a pretty amazing piece of cultural information. Mm. So it's sad to see him go, but unfortunately all things must pass.
Indeed.
And that's about it for that news.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that I remember reading Darwin's Radio, which I thought was very good, but I think of him more in terms of the science fiction novels Eon, and I think the following one was Eternity, was that right? There's a series, there's a trilogy of them, which is all about this infinitely long tunnel that's been drilled through space-time, kind of, and there's a city moving along the axis of this tunnel. It's a great concept.
Okay, all right. One of those big things that big concepts in science fiction.
Maybe we need to revisit.
We should
have talked about it on our mega structures episode.
Well, maybe we can do another one. But
it was a very popular episode. I have to tell you that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to hear.
People like big things.
Ooh. Okay, big things and big things blowing up. I think that's probably it.
Okay. So we're now going to move on to talking about something a few books we've been reading recently, and these are a couple of books which are very kindly given review copies by Text Publishing. So our thanks to Text Publishing for that. And we're going to start by talking about the latest novel by Gary Disher in his Paula Hirschhausen series set in South Australia. So do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I will. Thank you, David. Day's End is the title of this one. This is the 4th in the author series of novels featuring Paul Hirschhausen, otherwise known as Hirsch. He's a police constable in the small town of Tiverton in South Australia's mid-north. It's not quite based on Burra, but it's around that particular area, if you know the mid-north of South Australia. So Hirsch's rural beat is very large indeed, and at one point he likens it to the area of Belgium to somebody when he's trying to tell them that he can't be everywhere all at once. The previous volumes in this particular series were Bitterwash Road in 2013, Peace in 2019 and Consolation in 2020. And it's very good to see him back with a new entry in this particular series, because it is actually becoming one of my all-time favourites, I think. So anyway, this particular novel starts with Hirsch showing an international visitor, Jan van Sant, around the area of his town. She's come to Australia looking for her backpacker son who has gone missing. And his last known whereabouts were on a large sheep property on the outskirts of Tiverton, where he'd been working as a jackaroo. Now, while Hirsch is doing that, showing Van Sant around the town, he gets a call comes in about a roadside fire in the town, which turns out to be small, burning an old suitcase. But the interesting thing about this particular suitcase is they discover that it contains a male body. But they also determine that it's not that of the missing young man. So they have two particular problems that Hirsch is facing. So Hirsch's investigations begin, and apart from the missing boy and the dead man in the suitcase, he has to handle incidents in this book ranging from dog chasing children on bikes, his partner's daughter being bullied and harassed on social media, the shooting death of a prize ram, a dispute over a large artwork carved into the countryside, some vandalism of the local First Nations centre and a couple of Telstra telecommunications towers. He's also going to deal with COVID deniers and anti-vaxxers, because of course this was written during the period of the COVID lockdowns. There's also the misuse of some police videos, and there's also evidence that there's a white supremacist group in the area recruiting local young men and women. And the list just goes on and on. All these various things that he has to deal with while he's a small town copper in this small town. So basically he's up to his ears in crimes, really. And some of them, crimes, possible crimes, community disturbances and the like. Everything that a normal small town copper would have to face on a day-to-day basis. But this is not to suggest that this is all mundane and boring, of course. On the contrary, Disher is the master of descriptions of country towns and their inhabitants in a time when interpersonal relationships are being strained by social media and pandemic restrictions. And the reader should have no worries about the fact that all of these separate threads hang loose. They all can become resolved at the end rather satisfactorily, some rather tragically, as you might expect when you've got people that are missing or dead, but we won't give away any spoilers in that regard. Now, Hirsch himself is gradually integrating himself into the local community. He wasn't born there. He's posted there by the police. You'll recall that probably if you've read these earlier books or heard us talking about him, that in the first book or the end of the first book, beginning of the first book rather, he had been posted to Tiverton because he had become sort of tangentially involved in some police corruption in the Adelaide police station that where he was working. While he wasn't charged or accused of anything, the dirt and mud flung around, some of it stuck to him, and people were basically saying that because he was in that particular station, he must have known something or been involved in something. And so there were suspicions about him all the way through. But some of that seems to be starting to die down in this particular entry in the series. He's building a life for himself in town. He's got a partner, he's got a daughter. He's involved in lots of things around the town and from a socialist perspective, sport, helps out at the school and does a whole lot of things around town as a normal copper would do. He's basically starting to earn the respect of the local higher-ups in the police department. There's a nearby town where there is a major police station where his manager is situated, and he's starting to get a little bit more recognition for the work that he does. Even some of the coppers that come up from Adelaide to investigate the crimes that he discovers are also not treating him with the disdain that they used to. So all in all, he's starting to become probably earning his stripes a little bit better, and he's actually thinking about taking on studying for a sergeant's exam, but I sort of get the feeling that he doesn't really want to do that terribly much because he just likes the town as much as he can. Now, this is basically overall an excellent series of police procedurals set in an area of Australia that otherwise gets little or if any attention in the literary field. And in many ways, as I said, Tiverton can be a small town anywhere in Australia. It just happens to be in the mid-north of South Australia, which is an area that Disha knows extremely well. And you've, for many reasons, you have to put these books in the top echelon of the Australian of Australian crime series. And I, for one, can only hope that there's going to be a lot more instalments to come. Mm. I think Disha is just a cracker. There's lots of little bits in this particular book that just sort of hang there and are just sort of thrown away. There's a lovely little line where Hirsch, at one occasion, is a bit rushed after having been out and about all day and decides that he really needs to get something to eat. And he thinks about going to the local pub to get a meal. And then he realises, no, he better not do that because the publican's the one now doing the cooking, because the publican's wife's run off with the local craft beer representative. And this is just a straight throwaway little line. It's just in one sentence. He does it all. But that sort of adds to the atmosphere and building up of the detail of the town. It's layer on layer all the way right through, like a very well-layered cake. And it just fits really very, very well. You get the people with a lot of money and you get people that have got very little or no money at all. And so you get the full range of inhabitants in the town. And overall, I think these are excellent series of books and should be read.
Mm. I was worried when I saw the title, Day's End. I thought, maybe this is Gary Disha putting a line under this series. But when you get to the end of this book, again, I guess this is a spoiler, but when you get to the end of it, you realise that, no, there's plenty of scope for more.
One hope
series,
so.
Yeah, it's good. No, I really like the way that, as you say, he brings together all these different threads of a rural life. And somehow, he manages all these threads really cleverly. And finally, they all come together at the end and make sense of the mystery that's been laid out in the book. So, yeah, it's very, very good, I thought.
Not all of the threads are completely tied off. There are some people that don't get who's looking for that he can't find, and because they've done a runner, they basically have to be handed over to somewhere else. But he understands and knows why they've left and what happened to them before they left. And so from that perspective, as a reader, you come away satisfied that he has tied everything off, even though you haven't got maybe exactly everything that you might have wanted. Yeah.
It's interesting, too, that how much the job of a rural policeman is really welfare rather than crime.
Yeah.
There's just one line I pulled out, which is just, he's just been talking to some local who's been having problems, and he drives away. And realising yet again that he could never fully help people, never fully tackle or solve the headaches that came his way. And that's his life. Starting to get a bit of rain, so you may hear this on the recording. All right, well, we move on from that, and we'll talk about the other book, which we got a review copy from text, is Limberlost by Robbie Arnott. Now, Perry and I have talked in the podcast before about Robbie Arnott's first couple of books, both of which are excellent. So we were really looking forward to this latest book coming out, Limberlost. I thought this was brilliant. It's beautifully written and very moving, and it's certainly one of the best books I've read all year. If you've read the first couple of his books, you won't be surprised at how well it's written, because his first book, Flames, and his second book, The Rain Heron, are also beautifully, beautifully written, beautiful writing, quality of the writing. But what might surprise people is that in those first two books, there's definitely an element of fantasy or, out of the ordinary in them. The Rain Heron is a mythical creature which is composed of rain, for example. Flames has got a character who turns out to be the spirit of fire. So it might be surprising that this third novel is actually very realistic. It's just pure realism. Doesn't have any of those touches of the fantastic. But that doesn't detract from the book. It's still a really excellent book. It loses nothing for not having those fantastic elements. So I was going to say that Robbie Arnott's an Australian author, but he's also distinctively a Tasmanian author. All three of his novels so far are set in Tasmania. You might quibble with me about The Rain Heron because it's set in an unnamed country, but certainly has the feel of Tasmania in it. And this one is certainly very solidly based in Tasmania. And the author's love of Tasmania, its history, its landscape, its wildlife and vegetation, mountains, forests and rivers, more obvious in this novel than in his two previous ones. So what's it all about? Well, you can start by calling Limberlost a coming-of-age story, and I think that's definitely true, but it's really a coming-of-age story which lasts a lifetime, about how deeply felt experiences, both positive and negative, can resonate through someone's entire life and shape every moment. Now, that can happen with traumatic experiences, of course, but the key experiences which shape young Ned, who's the protagonist, that shape young Ned in Limberlost, are not in themselves traumatic as such, but nevertheless, they're profoundly important to him. There was a boy learning to be a man. So the protagonist is called Ned. He's called Ned West, and he's the youngest child of an apple farmer in northern Tasmania, and whose orchard is called Limberlost, which is named for an American book, Girl of the Limberlost, which is, I think, back from the 1950s, something like that, or earlier. Sorry, earlier than that. And though the novel ranges back and forth over Ned's entire life, the core of the story covers what happens to him during a long summer during the last year of the Second World War, when Ned is in his mid-teens. His two elder brothers have been fighting in different theatres of the war. The oldest, Bill, was in Singapore when it was captured by the Japanese, and nothing's been heard of him since. And the family, of course, are concerned that he's dead. The second eldest, Toby, is in Malaysia, and they do get occasional letters from him. And Ned's eldest sibling, his sister Maggie, who was been away for a while from home, has returned home to help their father now that the older boys have gone and can't help out. And Ned's mother died when he was very young. So because his mother died when he was young, he's grown up without the love of a mother, and with his father and two older brothers, who he idolises as role models, he's constantly filled with feelings of inadequacy and guilt compared to them. Because his brothers are off being heroes, and his father, who was also in the trenches in the First World War, is a hard, remote man who Ned struggles to please. So at the very start of the book, there's a brief passage describing an event when Ned was only 5 years old. There'd been a lot of fearful talk about a mad whale at the mouth of the river. This might be sort of your fantastic element if you want to see it as that. A mad whale at the mouth of the river smashing fishing boats and creating havoc. Ned's father, who scoffs at these fishermen's tales, takes his sons out in a small boat to show them there's nothing to fear. You don't find out what actually happened in this incident until much later in the book, but it has a strong influence on Ned, who, as the story proper opens, is trying to shoot and trap rabbits. He wants to earn enough by selling rabbit skins to buy a boat of his own. The rabbit belts are in demand by the army to make slouch hats for the war. So he kills a rabbit and he skins it very carefully and brings it to show his father. But his father misunderstands what Ned's all about. He interprets what Ned has done as being a selfless effort to help the war, help the army. Whereas really Ned has got this selfish idea of getting a boat out of the proceeds of these pelts. His father reacts completely differently from how Ned expected him to react, and he sort of then feels bad about it. But as time goes on, Ned tries to convince himself that his father's view of him, you know, carrying out this noble sacrifice is true. And then he kind of realizes he can do both. He can both make the hats, for, you know, make the pelts for the army and save for his boat. So he eventually sells the pelts for a good price, and his father's sort of gives him a sort of backhanded compliment. He negotiates with the guy he's selling the pelts to, and gets a good price and tells his father how he did. I'll just quote this a little bit. The old man drew on a faint, tired smile. "Well, you're either a hard lad or a thick one, although you don't seem thick to me." Ned was strangled hot and mute by this compliment. In this moment, life was not brimming with conflict. His skill was not linked to guilt or shame. So, you know, this is a really sort of backhanded comment, I guess. A compliment he gets from his father. That's about the best he can hope for. And his sister, Maggie, who's come to live with them, he hardly knows. She's been away from home for quite a part of his life. And her approval is rare and criticism frequent, though he longs to please her and to at least partially fill the place of her absent brothers. But then he fails to recognise that one of the farm's horses has gone lame and he doesn't do anything about it. And she's furious. She's furious for days about it. So there are two main events during the summer which shape the rest of Ned's life. Firstly, Ned eventually does get his boat. He buys it second-hand from someone, and it turns out to be an unexpected treasure. He's dreamed for years of his brothers returning from the war and being able to show them his boat, of his skills that he's required in being able to navigate it effortlessly on the river. But that, in fact, never actually occurs. And through his selfless actions to help his father's struggling business, instead, Ned is led to a point of deep grief. I won't give that away as a spoiler. The second major event is that in trying to trap whatever creature is trying to dig under the fence to get to Maggie's chickens, instead of the suspected fox or Tasmanian devil, he finds out that he's trapped a native quoll, which is a carnivorous marsupial about the size of a large cat. Its leg is broken and is stuck in the trap, but as Ned moves to kill it, he can't bring himself to do it. So he secretly keeps the quoll in a crate, and he feeds it by giving it scraps of rabbit meat. And this goes on for many months. But Ned is actually very bad at keeping secrets. Many times in his story, he lets into the open things he wanted to keep secret, to keep personal, to keep to himself. And so eventually the secret of the hidden quoll comes out. Now that's all in the core story of that key summer during the war, but the story roams back and forth over Ned's whole life. A decade later, when he's working for a logging company, felling the White Knights, which is the name they give to the towering manor trees, to his time mustering on a sheep station on the mainland, to his marriage and the birth of his children, to when he's running the orchard himself and is chosen by the local growers association to represent them overseas, to when his daughters are grown and at university, to his old age. This interleaving of all these parts of his life is done very smoothly and without any confusion to the reader. And at each point, we see how the events of the key summer have affected Ned's thinking and actions. The conclusion of that summer and of the book is a deeply moving incident, which again, I won't give away. But I was just going to say that not many books bring me to tears, but this one came very close to doing so. I love the book. I fully expect to see it on the shortlist for next year's Miles Franklin Award, and unless it has some very good competition, I think it's got a good chance of winning. What did you think of it, Perry?
Well, I have to pretty much agree with just about everything you said, which is a bit unfortunate. We've got nothing much more to say. No, this is wonderful stuff. This is just fantastic. The writing's of a quality that it's simple but complicated, and that's hard to describe. So I just want to read a little bit from near the end.
It's a book you want to quote from, that's right, all the time, isn't it?
Here's a piece from near the end of the book, which doesn't give away any spoilers, but gives a bit of an idea of Arnott's style and style of writing and the way that he goes about it. When the summer died, it went quietly. There was no final exclamation of heat, no furious storms, no flourish of violence. The season just came to an end and lay down. Instead of constant stifling dryness, the days began to hold whole catalogues of weather. Dewy mornings, warm lunchtimes, gusty nights. Skirts of rain drifted over Limberlost on little skips of wind, greening the grass, brightening the leaves. The sky shifted from brittle blue to something softer, a pale colour interrupted by streaks of thin, uncertain clouds. At dusk, it glowed peach and salmon. Beneath it, the river lay steely and waveless, cut by the eternal rhythm of its whirlpools. The sun retreated. Autumn's grace crept forward.
It's lovely.
It's just fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it's just so evocative of what's happening in the change of the seasons there, but done really well. You know, the idea that, you know, that you've got a pale colour interrupted by streaks of thin, uncertain clouds. Mm. You know, you know exactly what he's talking about here in terms of the Australian sky and the clouds that are there at the end of summer moving into something that's where the heat's going away and you're moving into something a little bit cooler. It's just phenomenally good. And this is indicative of the way that he writes all the way right through. There's no long, complicated stretches. It's just beautifully written and lovely to read. And it flows brilliantly. Now, as you also said, that it does jump backwards and forwards down the decades. You'll be dealing with one particular thing and then it will move to something much later in Ned's life. But everything is connected.
Yeah.
And you've just got to stick with it and you'll find where the connection is. Mm. And it just builds the picture of Ned and his life and what happens to him. Mm. It's a very good portrait of an Australian male who's struggling with emotions and is struggling with communication.
Mm.
Because he really does find it difficult to communicate with people. It's just a classic Australian male, and you get a really good view of the whole thing, the things that he does wrong, the things that he does right, things he does right but he doesn't get any recognition for, but he does them anyway because he thinks that's what he feels as though he should be doing. And I was very impressed with the way that Ned's character comes across here. It all just flows beautifully. And yes, I agree with you that I think that if this is not on a lot of the literary prizes next year, the shortlist of literary prizes next year, something's very wrong, because this is about as good as you're going to get, I would think. I gave this a very high score, and as I thought that I think it's if it's not among the best, it's because it is the best book I've read this year, I think. I don't think that I've read another novel that's as good as this one.
It's excellent.
Yes, it is.
All right. We move on from there?
I think we shall, yes.
I think we should talk to the person who designed the cover of the book that we've just been talking about.
Well, both the books that we've just been talking about. I want to talk to John, because he did both of the covers of these two particular books. And the first one I want to talk to you about is the Gary Disher Days End, which I have a copy of here, which I'll show the listener and show John. And I asked you before we started talking about this as to whether you'd chosen this particular photograph for a reason, and you said that I thought that it was from South Australia, and I said
that I had done my research and it is from the area in which the book is set.
Yes, and while it looks like a fairly generic countryside, and you could basically say, well, that could be anywhere in Australia. Well, no, it actually can't, because being an ex-South Australian myself, I can actually recognise the Stobie poles that are in this particular photograph.
What on earth is a Stobie
pole? What is a Stobie pole?
Ah, this is a little bit of information for you. Those large poles that are holding up the wires are called Stobie poles, and they only come from South Australia. And Stobie poles are this very strange, peculiar pole that is built...
from Stobies?
No, they're actually built from... how do I describe this? They have two rails or U-tube beams on the end, stuck about, I would have said probably 18, 20 centimetres apart, and filled with concrete. Now, they've probably got beams that go across them to hold them apart, and they're filled with concrete. And they are what's used for telegraph and electricity poles in South Australia. And I don't believe that they've ever been used anywhere else. So as soon as I saw them there, I had a look at it and I thought, had to get my glasses on to have a look. I said, yep, that's a Stobie pole. And that's why I knew it was from South Australia.
Yeah, well done.
So you are able to, if you agree, vouch for the authenticity of this book from front to back.
Pretty much.
Because he writes about an area in which you grew up, does he not?
Near. I was about probably 60 kilometres away from there.
Well, that's well within the area.
I grew up in what was referred to as the mid-north, but I'm more over, right over by the Flinders Ranges. He's more... over towards the middle of the mid-north, over towards the Murray River. So he's a lot closer to the Murray River than I am. But, yes, that's why I can read this and go, yep, I recognise all of this. I know what he's talking about. I know the weather that he's talking about, and I know the countryside and what it's like and what the rains are like. the small holdings that the farmers have. But some of them get really, really, really big. But a lot of, where I grew up, a lot of the farms were mixed farming. So there was a bit of wheat, bit of sheep, but they were small and only just enough to look after one family, and that was it. But he's very accurate. He's very accurate.
So how did you go about finding that photograph?
I used a thing called Search Field.
Okay.
I inserted all the names and all the names of the towns and whatever, and I looked until I found something suitable.
And you were able to get the rights to it, obviously.
Yes. It also, of course, had to be an evening shot because of the title.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. And did you design all of the covers for these Hirsch series?
I have. In fact, I think I'm able to say this. I provided the title for the first in the series.
Is that right? Wow, very good.
I think we were in a state where we didn't really have a title. I said, well, look, he goes down this road all the time. So why don't we name it after the road? And there you had it. Bit of wash.
Which is a great title.
It's a good title. And it's a good name for a road, and it's a good title.
It's a wonderful evocation, isn't it? Bitter wash. Bitter wash is what every crime novelist sort of is.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It is.
And so when you come to designing a series like this, there's a great deal of consistency from each title to the next.
Well, when I did Bitter Wash Road, which is quite a few years ago now, I didn't know it was going to be a series. We didn't know. I mean, that was the first book. And it may or may not have continued. Who would have known? So, no, that was a one-off. And then I think at some point Gary decided to do more.
Well, I think what makes them stand out is the typography. I mean, that's this the great sort of distressed sort of look to the.
So that typography started with Peace.
Yes.
And that was when Gary, I think, had decided this would become a series.
I see.
And at that point, we thought, let's give it a series look.
Yeah,
so we retro-designed the first book in the series for a reissue later on.
Yes, I thought I'd seen it with that kind of typography to it. So when you come to design, this obviously it's your profession. You read every book that you do the cover for?
I read every fiction title, but for example, because of the way publishing works, quite often I have to do this quite a long time ahead, like, you know, a year ahead sometimes. And the case of the latest Disher, I can say that I haven't read the book. I read the three or four chapters which were available at the time to read. And I had discussions with the editor and so on. And so the cover is not based on the whole book, which I'm yet to read. I'm saving it up for Christmas.
Oh, fair enough.
I think you'll enjoy it over Christmas. It's a really, it flows beautifully. You know, it's just, I'm sort of loath to say it's an easy read because it sounds then like it's
That's
sort
what
of,
crime is.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, sometimes...
Even the worst crime is an easy read.
Yeah, but sometimes the novels can be, sometimes they can be a bit of a slog, but this just isn't a slog at all.
That just means it's a boring crime book?
Could be. Well... Yeah, but sometimes they can be really complicated and sort of jumping all over the place. But he isn't. He isn't with this. You know, it sort of concentrates on his main character, and you get what the main character knows and his interactions, and that's it. And I like that. It sort of gives you a sense that you're there, you know, walking along next to him and seeing what goes on and getting what happens.
It's enough to give even me nostalgia for a small town in South Australia.
Well, it sort of gives you a little bit of nostalgia, but I don't want to go back and live there. No, thanks. No.
Well, it's interesting that both of these novels are sort of set in rural Australia in different places. So if we move on to Limberlost, which has also got an excellent cover. Again, how did you sort of come up with a cover like that?
But you know that the book is sort of like a fictionalized biography of Robbie Arnott's grandfather.
Ah.
So, I mean, these two books obviously have roots in the author's history. Disha growing up in the South Australian area, Arnott's grandfather's story here. So that's why they are kind of based in that kind of regional space. And this cover comes out of reading the manuscript, which was finished, if not edited. And the image, which is a painting, is derived entirely from the reading of the manuscript. I had no idea of what I was going to do before I read it. I don't really have a program when I'm designing. And one night, I just had this thought, oh, it kind of looks like this. And it's very hard to describe that kind of thing because all I had was some image in my head, which I knew could translate into a non-realist painting. And I made a little scribble on a bit of paper, which is about, 3 inches by 2 inches. And I sent it to the editor and said, I'm thinking of this. What do you think? And he shopped it around the office. And he said, okay, let's have a look. So then I painted it. And it's quite a sizable piece. It's like a meter by something. So then after all that effort, the question is, what would the author think? Thankfully, the author thought, okay. And I think his remark to the editor was something like, I was hoping it'd be something with nature in it. And this looks just like something out of the book.
Great.
Which is true. Mm-hmm. It is something out of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got two of the main motors from the book, the boat.
Yeah, you can see that as the boat.
As the boat and then the trees.
Yeah, it's good. Do you ever have a situation where an author doesn't like the cover that you've designed?
Oh, yes. Oh, so many times. There is one, in fact, that's out in the shop now, which I won't name, which had to go back to the author 4 times, I think, which is quite a lot. Certainly quite a lot for me, anyway. And this going to the author is quite a process because it means it has to be approved, if that's the term, by everyone involved in the book in the office. So it may have had up to like 6 or 7 ticks in the box before it goes to the author.
Yeah.
And to do that 3 or 4 times is a lot of ticks in the box.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
So everybody gets seriously sick of it after a while.
Yeah. Well, you don't really want to do design by committee, do you? But I suppose in your sort of circumstances, it's kind of like that.
Well, it's approval by committee, which is a slightly different
thing. They're not actually putting their oar in about the actual design, but
it's approval by committee before the potential veto by the author.
What a pain. I can imagine that.
So the great dream of the cover designer is to produce a design. I think the term I would like to use is undeniable. That the second that whoever needs to approve of it sees it, they go, okay.
Yeah.
And that's what you want.
Yeah.
You want it to be okay all along the way up to the author.
So you want basically the image that you put there to be as part of the whole of the package, and it's always going to stay as that part of the package.
I think what John's trying to say, I'm putting words in your mouth here, but that it has to look inevitable. That cover is almost the inevitable cover for the book.
I think that's right. You've got to look at it and think, of course, that is what this book is.
It's interesting that we've discussed this a bit occasionally, that some of the covers that you've done for some of the books for text publishing that have gone on to be published overseas have had a cover which is different from yours, but utilises a lot of the design elements that you put into the original one. So that's interesting, and that's where that comes in, is that idea that there is a certain image that you think of when you come with that particular book. Mm. Even if it's slightly manipulated, it's still there.
So I guess it's the difference between, say, a conceptually based design or image as opposed to one, say, like Limberlost. So Limberlost is a unique image because it's a painting based on a manuscript, whereas Day's End by Gary Disher has a cover featuring a photo of the area in which the story is set. So you could find any number of photos that might well fit that kind of idea for a cover, whereas you couldn't replicate this painting without basically copying the painting.
Yeah. Yes, in that instance. It'll be interesting to see what some foreign publishers make of this. Is Arnett being published overseas here? There was a variant on your Rain Heron cover, wasn't there?
Most overseas, well, let me rephrase that. The UK and the US like designing their own covers because their attitude to Australian design is that we can do better.
Mm-hmm.
So the UK will almost never accept an Australian design because, you know, well, it's just not going to fit our place, is it?
Well, the colonials, what do they know?
Whereas we will take a cover from somewhere else if it looks like...
If it suits.
If it's fine.
Yeah.
It's kind of reverse cultural cringe, isn't it? But, it's that must be very annoying.
I guess they have to keep their designers in employ.
Well,
why
I guess
not?
That's true, true. We should make sure that we employ designers. That's true.
So do you find that you are working on books that are going to be appearing well into next year?
Yes. I'm currently looking at 3 or 4 manuscripts which probably won't be published as books until this time next year.
Okay.
And I think they work even further ahead in the UK and the US.
Mm. It shows you how long it takes to actually get a book out once the author's finished it, which takes a long while.
Yeah, authors must be so frustrated half the time.
Mm.
Are we there yet?
Well, you're getting to this point where you're talking about I've read interviews with authors and they say, "So what were you doing here?" And they say, "I don't know, I've completely forgotten." Why? Well, I've been just, and the person said, "But I've just read this," and yeah, but I read it 3 years ago. You know, I've moved on. I've written 1.5 books since then, and it's only taken the time for it to come out now. So,
I suppose there's an issue there, isn't there, about topicality? Because that's the thing about Day's End. It's still pretty topical about anti-vaxxers and the pandemic. Mind you, the pandemic's gone for 3 years now, hasn't it? So, it's not really surprising. But he's, even in his previous book, he brought in the beginnings of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
In that, so it can't be too long of a delay between when the book is written and when it comes out, because otherwise, public affairs change so rapidly.
Yeah.
But if you're going to refer to them, then it's hard to stay up to date.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what does happen in that instance. Is the Disher novel going to lose its topicality because of the fact that it's dealing with some of the issues? Well, Some of the issues like the anti-vaxxers,
do you think maybe anti-vaxxers are going to go away? Or
no, they're not. But no, they are. No, I don't believe they are. But are they going to be as rampant in the future? I mean, there are a few other things that are there which I think is actually going to probably keep going. I mean, there's a white supremacist group that is recruiting a number of young men and women in the town, and that isn't going away anytime soon that I can see. I think that politics here and overseas is becoming more separated. It's just moving further away, and people that are on one side seem to be going quite
Does it matter, though?
No, it doesn't. No. It's because just interesting to see how they
if you're
runs.
Writing with these kind of things as your material, then they end up being texture, and you can read it out of time, and it doesn't matter because it just informs why people do what they do at the time they're doing it. And, you know, whether it's a plague or something else, it's just a contextual MacGuffin. It's not really to the point.
I mean, there's a real sense, isn't there, in that every novel, every work of fiction is actually historical fiction. Because it's, you know, almost as soon as it's written, it's set in the past.
Yeah.
So every portrait painting is a history painting of some kind.
Yeah.
Well, actually, this is a historical podcast.
Could be, sir.
Could be.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I don't know. I think we've probably covered most of the ground.
I think thanks very much for coming along, Chong, and having a bit of a chat to us today. I mean,
my pleasure seeing a couple of pros at work.
It's been very interesting to see the book covers and seeing. I really do like the one for Limber Lost. I like the one for Day's End as well, and I like that. They're two completely different styles, which is interesting.
Well, they're two different styles because they're two different bases.
Yeah.
So the Disher one's part of a series, and the thing about crime novel covers, as you know, they do tend to have a kind of a current genre kind of delivery of some, you know, natural pastoral scene of some kind. All the rural noir books certainly do anyway.
Yep.
Whereas Robbie Arnott in this case slots into literary fiction, and it's not part of a series, and it really could have been anything. Could have been a photo, could have been type, could have been what it is. So that has a different requirement. It has to have a different inspiration. And in this case, unlike the Disher cover, I was working in the dark. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what I needed to do. I didn't know until I knew.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
We might wind up there.
I think we should. We'll be back in 3 weeks.
3 weeks' time. What are we going to talk about in 3 weeks' time?
Well, maybe what we've been reading
just
lately.
What we've been reading. I've got a heap of books I haven't talked about yet on the podcast.
Well, okay. And that'll be our last one for the year.
It will.
And then we'll go into a bit of a break and come back in the new year with our picks of the best books of the year, and then I'll do my best film and TV
books this year. I must say, I mean, that's going to be in my top 10 for sure, probably number one,
possibly.
And I'm holding up Limber Lost. But I've read some other crackers this year.
Okay, well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah,
thanks, Chong. Thanks for coming along. We'll hope to talk to you again sometime in the future about some other things that we can come up with, some other subjects.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. Indeed. A bit early, but we'll get there. That's good. Thanks very much.
Good.
All right. Indeed. And that's it. See you in 3 weeks, David.
Yep. See you then. Bye.
Bye.